The 19th century English historian and politician, Lord John Dalberg Acton, was a widely respected writer in his own day. Today, however, he is primarily known for a single quote that he wrote. "Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." If people know anything about Lord Acton, they know that quote. Interestingly, its original context was a letter to a fellow scholar in 1887, a letter in which he was explaining why he, as a devout Catholic, opposed the recent introduction of the doctrine of papal infallibility into the Roman Catholic Church. The First Vatican Council had passed a decree declaring that the Pope, when speaking on certain matters of faith and order, could not possibly err. And Lord Acton, despite how much he admired and honored the Pope, simply could not agree. "I cannot accept," he wrote, "your claim that we are to judge Pope and King unlike other men, with a favorable presumption that they did no wrong. If there is any presumption, it is the other way, against the holders of power, increasing as the power increases." And then comes his most famous statement. "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men, even when they exercise influence and not authority, still more when you add the tendency or the certainty of corruption by authority. We shouldn't presume that those with power are going to do what is right, because, as Acton says, great men are almost always bad men." Now, that might sound overly cynical to many people today. Maybe you think that's a bit too cynical of a view on life. But Lord Acton wasn't alone in his rather pessimistic outlook on human tendencies. Nor was he the only one who thought that such tendencies were the precise reason why power ought to be limited. In fact, Lord Acton was simply repeating a perspective that almost all of the American founding fathers would have readily agreed with. When the founding fathers were writing the Constitution, their reason for insisting on a democratic form of government and limiting the powers of different branches of the government was not because they thought that human beings are basically good and wise and deserve to make their own decisions. Actually, quite the opposite is true. They agreed with Lord Acton. They thought that people, not just people with power, but all people are easily corrupted, and that people tend to act for their own self-interest, and that that is why no one should ever be given too much power. As George Washington once put it in a letter to James Madison, "The motives which predominate most in human affairs are self-love and self-interest." John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, was even more definitive and succinct. "The mass of men are neither wise nor good." C.S. Lewis once observed that there are two possible reasons for supporting democracy. You may think that all people are so naturally good and so wise that they deserve a share in political power and they ought to be consulted for their opinions. Or, he says, you may think that people are so naturally corrupt that no one should be entrusted with too much power. That, he argues, is the true ground of democracy. But what does any of this have to do with the book of Deuteronomy? Why begin this lesson with a foray into political philosophy and the reasons for democratic government? Well, because the book of Deuteronomy is, as we have seen, a collection of laws. Laws that are meant to guide the way the nation of Israel operates, including the way that political power should be used. And as we come to chapter 17, what we find are several laws that establish legal limits and safeguards meant to protect people from the corruption and abuse of power. And their reason for doing so, I would suggest, is essentially the same reason that Lord Acton didn't think Catholics should accept papal infallibility, and the same reason that the American founding fathers tried to protect democracy and limited government. Because even though power itself is not bad, power can easily be corrupted, and people tend to mistreat each other. Let me explain what I mean. At the very end of Deuteronomy chapter 16, after all the instructions about the annual festivals that we already discussed, there are three verses establishing laws for judges. First is simply a command that judges be appointed. You shall appoint judges and officers in all your towns that the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. After that, three separate prohibitions are given to the judges themselves, explaining what it means to judge with righteous judgment, or more specifically, what one must avoid. You shall not pervert justice, you shall not show partiality, and you shall not accept a bribe. Both of these laws, the one commanding that judges be appointed and the one prohibiting judges from abusing their position, both of them presume that Lord Acton and George Washington, that what they said is pretty much correct, that people tend to act for their own self-interest, and that even those in power are easily corrupted. Take the first one, the law that orders judges to be appointed. Why would such a thing be necessary in the first place? If judges are so easily corrupted, why not allow people to just sort out their own affairs? If you continue to read the story of Israel, that will become apparent enough. The book that comes just two books after Deuteronomy, the book of Judges, Judges records this ongoing tragic cycle of the people's fall into immorality and idolatry and injustice. And the very last verse of that book ends with an acknowledgement that neither kings nor judges are governing human affairs at that time, but instead that everyone is doing what is right in his own eyes, which, as the book of Judges makes clear, is very bad indeed. No one should want to live in a society where everyone does whatever they think is right. You need someone to settle disputes. But you don't have to read all the way to the end of Judges to find that out. Deuteronomy itself anticipates the problem in chapter 17. First, it talks about what you should do if someone is found committing idolatry. Deuteronomy says that the penalty for idolatry is death. But then in verse 6, it gives some rules about how an accusation of idolatry should be handled. On the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. Why require two or three witnesses? Simple. Because people lie. People have a tendency to make false accusations against their neighbors. And Deuteronomy is giving a vision for a just society, but Deuteronomy also presumes that people aren't necessarily just. Sometimes we treat each other abominably. So we got to have laws protecting each other from slander. Similarly, the following passage gives laws about what to do when a judgment about a case involving injury or manslaughter is disputed. If the local judge can't determine who's at fault or what to do, then Moses says, "You shall come to the Levitical priests and to the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall consult them." Basically, you need to create a lower court system and a higher court system for cases that are either too complicated or for which there is good reason for appeal. Why? Well, two reasons. First, because judges aren't infallible. And second, because whenever someone has committed violence against another person, intentional or not, our tendency is to react with anger and seek revenge. It's just what humans do. And Deuteronomy knows that about the human heart. So it establishes laws to protect people from the power of anger and the desire for vengeance. Why? Again, because, as John Jay said, because the mass of men are neither wise nor good. And because even judges, even those in power, can be corrupted. God knows that. Otherwise, he wouldn't have warned them. He wouldn't have needed to warn them against perverting justice or showing favoritism or accepting bribes. The fact that Deuteronomy prohibits those things means that it knows that power corrupts. So we need judges to protect us from one another, but we also need laws to protect us from corrupt and incompetent judges. Then, after all these laws about judges and court cases, in the final part of Deuteronomy 17, we find some laws about kings. Now, it's rather strange that these laws are here in the first place. After all, at this point in their history, Israel doesn't have any kings. Moses is leading them. And later, in 1 Samuel chapter 8, when they demand a king, it's clear that God does not approve of their request. And the prophet Samuel warns them against it. So why then does Deuteronomy have laws about kings? Well, apparently, God knows that Israel will later demand a king. Not that he thinks they should. Unlike the laws about judges, there are no commands telling the people that they should elect a king, only knowing that they will. As Moses puts it in verse 14, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me. The Lord knows that the people are going to make this demand at some point. And he tells them, okay, when that happens, and you insist on having a king like the other nations, you're allowed to. But then he gives some very clear restrictions about what their king may and may not do. A king can't acquire a lot of horses, for instance, nor can he accumulate many wives, nor may he build a large royal treasury of silver and gold. What's more, after his coronation, the first thing a king must do is have a personal copy of this law, as Moses calls it, which is really a reference to the whole of the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The first thing a king must do is get his own personal copy of these books and then dedicate himself to reading and studying it for the rest of his life, so that as he goes about his work, he may do what God has instructed. Of course, that doesn't mean that Deuteronomy assumes kings won't have anything else to do with their time. Of course, they'll have many, many other responsibilities. But as one commentator notes, as is so often the case, Deuteronomy mentions only what matters. In this case, it avoids the small print of an exhaustive job description for royalty and concentrates on the fundamental priority. But why, you might ask, why have these laws at all? If you're going to allow kings, why not just emphasize the need to choose a good king and not a bad one? Because power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The reason that God forbade the accumulation of horses and women and riches is because these are the things that can corrupt a king. Horses are, or at least they were at that time, horses were a military resource. So the more horses a king had, the more trust he and his people could put in their own strength, and the less they would need to depend on God to defend them. What does Psalm 20 say? Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. That is a statement of faith. But military power can corrupt that kind of faith and make it very tempting to actually trust in chariots and horses instead. In the same way, as God has warned the Israelites, many wives and foreign wives can corrupt a man's heart, can lead him away from the love of God and lead him into idolatry. It can happen even to the wisest of kings, like King Solomon. As we read in 1 Kings chapter 11, for when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God. God knows the human heart. He knows our tendency toward selfishness and deceit. He knows that even the best of men can be corrupted by pride and power. So he sets down these laws in Deuteronomy. If you're going to have a king, then don't allow him to build a big military, or marry a bunch of wives, or build up a big treasury. And make sure he studies the law day in and day out so that he will understand what it means to rule with justice. Now, it's obvious when you're reading these laws that Deuteronomy is not attempting to set up a democratic system of government in the way that America's founding fathers did. Moses assumes that laws will be made by a king, not by an elected legislature. But just as Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution sets limits on congressional power, so these laws prescribe limits to the power of kings, because God knows that power corrupts. And God knows, as John Jay said, that the mass of men are neither wise nor good. And people are going to need protection from false accusations and from tyrannical kings. Of course, as the Apostle Paul says in his letter to the Romans, there are limits to what these laws could do. These laws in Deuteronomy can teach us what is right. And they can protect us maybe from the worst of human impulses. But in and of themselves, these laws cannot create just people. They can warn about the tendency to corrupt, but they cannot cure the corruption that lies in our hearts. That is something that God alone can do. And that, as Paul says, is precisely what God has done in the death and resurrection of his Son and the sending of his Spirit. So Deuteronomy's laws are not the final answer, but they do give us wisdom. And they do tell us something true about the human condition, that power corrupts, and that even those without power are often neither wise nor good.